live events, and for the next hour, I will be your host here on the radio. If you don't know The Moth, it's a collection of live stories, often personal, told without notes in front of an audience. It's what I used to call New York City's best-kept secret until the secret got out, and now it's one of those secrets that you tell your friends, but you assure them that no one must know. So if you like the show, tell your friends, but only one or two, at most 10. This is a particularly exciting hour of stories for me. Some of my favorite storytellers. We're going to have three stories. We're going to hear about the rise and fall of a professional card player, a stand-up comedian's hell gig, and an unusual connection at a funeral parlor. Our first storyteller is Josh Axelrod. The night he told this story was the first time I'd ever seen him, and I was really blown away. He has this very frenetic style that's so enjoyable to watch. Here's Josh Axelrod live at the Moth.
Thank you. I was walking down Park Avenue, as I'm sure many of you have done, in a haze bordering on insanity. It was my fifth day of insomnia. I was starting to hallucinate. The buildings were swirling around me, and the sun was pounding down. And I didn't know where I wanted to go to. I had just come out of my shrink's office, and she said she thought that my anxiety and my sleeplessness had to do with my financial situation, which was bad. I was carrying about $30,000 in credit card debt and had less than a grand in my checking account. Minimum payments due in a week that I couldn't quite make. And she said, in light of this, she thought it was time that I think about looking for work. And I thought that was crazy. So I left in a bit of a huff and was right at Park and 25th. And I walked by this building that I'd seen a lot in the past. It was a stone structure. It looked like a bank, sort of an austere, serious facade. But I saw a sign in the window that I'd never noticed before. And it said, cash loans for gold. And I thought, this is not a mainstream lending institution. And I stopped. I looked down at my watch, not to check the time, but to confirm that I was still wearing the solid gold Bulgari that I inherited from my grandfather, and I was, so I stepped through the door thinking, has it really come to this? Now, I wasn't supposed to be broke. I didn't think it was part of God's plan for me to be broke. In fact, just 3 years earlier, I sold a book to a major New York publishing house for a good bit of money. Now, I hadn't written that book. I hadn't written it yet. It was an original deadline had come and then gone, and there was another deadline that was 3 months away, and I continued not to have written it. So there was no manuscript. This was an additional source of sleeplessness, and it was also part of why I didn't want to work. I needed time so that I could write, but I couldn't write because I was so freaked out because of my financial situation, so it was a bit of a self-perpetuating cycle. And to make matters worse, the book was to be titled Repeat Until Rich. And it was a memoir. It was a story of how I had fallen in with a group of professional card counters and for 5 years earned my living winning money from casinos at blackjack, which I did. And I think part of why it was so hard for me to write is that I knew that getting to the end of it and typing the end and, you know, closing the file or, you know, closing the book would mean that that part of my life, which in many ways had been very magical, was behind me, that it was really over. And I couldn't quite let go of it. Card counting is a sort of magical thing. You come into the casino and you feel like the ultimate badass. Everybody around you is a sucker, the people at the tables, the pit bosses too, because you're going to win money from them, and even the people outside the casinos who have to work honest jobs for a living, they're all suckers, and you feel like you're in this extraordinary position. In addition to that, when you walk into a casino, you know, just so you understand, with card counting, blackjack is this game where certain cards in the deck are disproportionately favorable to players, and what a card counter does is just keep track of those cards. And when you find a deck that's rich in these good player favorable cards, you bet more, and that's it. So you bet small and you count the cards and bet small, and then you find a good count and you bet a lot and then small again. And this pattern is conspicuous. Casinos are able to identify it, and when they do, they ask you to leave, or they tell you to leave. So the moment you walk into a casino in a card counting session, a clock begins to tick, and it's only a matter of time before they figure you out or recognize you because they exchange photographs with each other. They take photographs. You can walk into a casino that some other casino has sent photographs of and be thrown out even though you've never played there before and they haven't even seen you in action. And the same thing happens on a grander time scale also. Over the course of your card counting career, you start out with a clean face, unknown to the casinos, and you're able to play everywhere. And over time, you run out of options and you become hot and feel the whole experience of it beginning to slip through your fingers. It started to happen to me. I started in Las Vegas playing big casinos, the best places in the world to play blackjack in, and within a couple years, 2002, 2003, I was being sent on trips to northern Indiana, and not just northern Indiana, to Gary, Indiana, and not just to Gary, but to the Majestic Star, the woefully misnamed Majestic Star, which is a casino that they never let card counters play. For one thing, they always throw you out immediately, but it's also a terrible... You walk onto this boat that it looks like somebody bought on eBay, and the smoke is choking the chambers inside of it, and the floor, the carpet is indistinguishable. You can't tell if it's the actual design or vomit or some other thing. You just don't even know. And you walk up to the table, and I was walking into this place where they always throw people out, and I thought, what act can I use? This is part of what you do as a counter. You come in with a story, who you are, what you're about. I'm a drug dealer, or I own a nightclub, and I deal in a lot of cash, and that's why I have money. You sort of want it to make sense that you're betting the way you are. But I walked into this place thinking, what can I possibly do? They're going to throw me out. I thought, the only thing that will cause them to accept wagers from me is if they think that I'm cognitively void, that I've been lobotomized. And so I thought, that's it. My act is lobotomized. And I walked up to the table. There was no story. I didn't explain anything. I used three words of vocabulary, and I started betting and counting. And when the count went up, I bet more, and I was grunting and drooling. No story. Lobotomized. That was it. And as soon as I started to bet large, somebody new entered the pit, as happens. It was an older person, had an aura of authority about him, and he walked in and walked right over to behind the table where I was betting and started looking at me like they do. They like to look you right in the eye and sort of put the read on you. And if you can convince them with your act that you're, you know, a crazy person or what have you, you can buy yourself a little more time. And he looked right at me, and it was this moment that I always loved in a blackjack session. It was the moment of truth, because you really don't know what they're going to do. I mean, I know the truth, which is that I'm a badass and he's a sucker, but I want to look like a sucker. And he looked in my eyes, and I couldn't think of anything to do or say, so I just opened my mouth a little bit further and let a little bit of extra drool spill out of one side of it. And his eyes lit up, and he beamed at me, and a few minutes later, he was grabbing my arm and offering me comps, and he never even threw me out. I was never barred at the Majestic Star, and I ended up using this lobotomized character in casino after casino, going around the country at a time when I should have been out of options, finding new options all over the place, thinking that I had really cheated death, that maybe this perverse way of life might actually be sustainable indefinitely. Maybe time had stopped, but it hadn't. Our group ended up splitting up for a number of reasons. We all became very hot, and the blackjack conditions in Las Vegas changed materially so that we were making much less money. And I sat down at home and started trying to write and to learn how to write. And eventually I got an agent, and I put together a book proposal. And to my astonishment, it was purchased. And I found myself in a new life, sitting at the computer, writing or trying to write. But every time I started a sentence in which the blackjack stories were taking place in the past tense, I couldn't quite bear it, and I became restless, and I would log on to the internet just to procrastinate a little bit, bang out some money maybe on an internet poker site, send $100 or $200 over to some offshore website, you know, based in some other country, and I wasn't good at poker. Poker is a game like blackjack that you can beat if you're skilled, but I wasn't, and I knew that. This wasn't work. This was a busman's holiday, so to speak. It was just recreation. And I would win, I would lose. It was just a little procrastination thing, not a big deal. At the end of the first month, I realized I was down $2,000, and I thought, all right, this is counterproductive. And the following month, changed my ways entirely, started getting up early in the morning, which I had never done, having coffee, sitting down at the computer, taking a breath, typing a sentence, realizing that the past tense felt wrong and false and jarring, and that none of the writing was not good either. And I thought, well, I logged onto the internet, I beamed $500 or $700 over to Gibraltar, and played a little bit, killed some time, and while I was doing it, I realized quickly that I was in a different sort of cognitive space. It was very different from blackjack, from playing with an edge, knowing you're supposed to win. I knew I was supposed to lose, and I was losing, and I felt a little bit out of control. It began to mount and become more obvious that I was doing something bad, and even though the actual activity was to me so different from card counting, the feeling of uncertainty and of danger was very familiar, and I liked that feeling. It was like the moment of truth every single moment, so long as I was in action. It was very exciting. The second month, I lost $7,000, and I saw the cumulative result becoming something poor, so I continued to play, having entered a period of really being somewhat out of control, I guess. I was writing very little, and playing a lot of online poker. And by the end of the summer, I was down about $20,000, which I saw as problematic. So I went to a therapist, and he said, all right, well, we're going to get you in Gamblers Anonymous. And I said, listen, there are two things that professional gamblers or former professional gamblers don't do. They don't get jobs, and they don't go to Gamblers Anonymous. That means the whole sort of dream is really dead. I'm not doing that. And he said, all right. And after a few sessions, he said, I can't see you anymore. You're too unstable, which I took offense to. So I stormed out. And I continued to play badly online poker. And it had become something else. Now it was a full-time thing. I was now a full-time professional losing gambler. And by 6 months and then 9 months, I wasn't able to snap myself out of this state. And a year later, the following summer, I had lost $50,000, which was the extent of my available cash. So unless I was going to go into embezzlement or really take things to the next level, I saw that I had to get a little help. And I started going to these programs where there were these people who were the sorts of people we used to mock inside the casinos, and they were really shattered. And we would share our stories, and mine didn't make any sense to them, and theirs didn't make any sense to me. But I went, and then I went home and played a little bit of poker, and then I went, and I went home and played a little poker. I went to four meetings, and I saw that I wasn't able to see myself as a peer with these people. I couldn't accept that. So I thought, I'm going to stop just so I don't have to call myself one of them. I can't handle that. That I can't do. And I did stop. And that meant to me accepting that blackjack and that magical period was behind me, and accepting that I had annihilated $51,000 trying to preserve it. The following year, I spent playing Scrabble on the internet. It was a healing period. I didn't lose any money. I didn't write anything. And in February of 2008, I was standing in this pawn shop hallucinating from all the exhaustion, days of no sleep, and I walked up to the window. The man kind of had this wan smile, and I put the watch through the slot, and the first thing he said to me was, well, you know, this is plated. And I, at that moment, I couldn't tell, is this a movie where they tell you the thing that, like, you know it is, but they say that it's not? And he's really like, are you really doing? I said, it's not. It's solid. This is solid gold, man. And he said, well, I'll take a look. And he brought it somewhere to examine it, came back a minute later and said, I'm sorry. My mistake. It is solid gold. He said, I can give you $600 for it. And I said, this watch is worth $5,000. I had it appraised 2 years ago. And he said, actually, it's worth $7,000 now. I can give you $600. The watch I can move is a Rolex. And this isn't a Rolex, so if I sell it, that's what I get. You can take it or leave it. And he put it back in the slot. And he just looked at me. And I realized that he had looked at a lot of people standing where I was standing. And it reminded me of the man in the pit looking at me in blackjack. Only then I knew who I was. And now I felt like I didn't know. Was I the ultimate degenerate who actually pawns the last thing he has from his grandpa to get enough money to live for another month? And I grabbed the watch. I said, oh, maybe, you know, another time, not today. And he said, I hope you find what you're looking for. And I walked outside, took a breath, saw the sun coming down. It wasn't so bad. And I got on the subway, and I went to my local, my bank, and took out a credit card that had been issued by that bank, and I put it in the slot. The teller looked up at me, and I said, I would like a cash advance. And I took out a cash advance for $1,000. And as I signed the form, I thought, this is not a sustainable way of life, but it buys me a month, and that's what I want right now, just a little more time. Thank you.
That was Josh Axelrod live at a show called Hoodwinked, Stories of Fooling and Being Fooled. He actually does complete the book he's talking about, and it's called, and I love this title, Repeat Until Rich, A Professional Card Counter's Chronicle of the Blackjack Wars.
Now let me tell you people about this blackjack game. It caused me so much trouble, I'll have myself to blame. Hey, hey, hey.
While we're on the subject of books, if it weren't for The Moth, I'm not sure I would have ever written a book. Before The Moth, I did kind of straightforward stand-up comedy, and after doing The Moth, I got the courage to tell more stories. And my first Moth main stage show, I told my sleepwalking story that they re-aired on This American Life, and it's actually the basis of my book. So The Moth has a very special place in my heart. In a moment, we're going to hear a story about a tough guy father who changed his nickname from Trouble to Bubbles.
The Moth is supported by Makers 46, handcrafted bourbon finished in barrels with seared French oak staves, online at makers46.com. Makers 46 Bourbon Whiskey, 47% alcohol by volume, distilled in Loretto, Kentucky, reminds listeners to drink responsibly. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
Maybe you start your day with the news on Morning Edition
and catch up later with All Things Considered.
But the news continues during the day in courtrooms, financial markets, on the streets, and at kitchen tables.
Locally, nationally, around the world.
Each afternoon, check in with Here and Now for the news as it's happening.
That's Here and Now from WBUR and NPR News.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Community Concierge Magazine. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and maps, as well as a business and shopping guide. Community Concierge Magazine is distributed throughout East Central Illinois and always presents the CU area at its best.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Mike Birbiglia. The next story is from Daisy Rosario. Daisy came up through the Moth Story Slam and now volunteers in the Moth Shop Community Program, which teaches storytelling skills to underserved populations. She acts as both a storyteller and a coach. Here's Daisy, live at the Moth.
Hello, yeah. Thank you. Yes? Hi. So my father had just died, and after 3 days of sitting in my teeny tiny studio apartment staring at walls and eating in excess, it was finally Friday, the funeral. I was eager to get the funeral over with. I wanted the event of my father's dying to be finished so I could just mourn and grieve, but it felt like there was still so much business to be had. It was about 2 hours before the funeral when I received a text message from my mother. It said, "I just called your grandmother to give her my condolences. Your brother was there. You're going to get to meet him." Now, my brother and I had never met, never spoken, never seen each other, nothing. We were raised on opposite coasts by our moms, him in California and me in Brooklyn, pretty much because, well, my dad was not a good man. And you should know that I'm fine with this fact. My father was a thug, a drug dealer. Sometimes, to keep it simple, I like to say he was what rappers claim to be all the time. But more than anything, he was a fighter. He was a fighter in the streets. He was a prison boxing champion. And I watched him fight for over 2 years as AIDS ravaged his once very strong body. In the end, we had to make the decision to take him off of life support. And that was the week that I had had when I got this text message from my mother. So I had no energy or emotional stamina by which to be nervous or even worried about meeting my brother. But I do remember thinking two things. I remember thinking, one, I was hoping he would be a distraction because my recent reconnection with the family had made me something of a novelty, and I was a little tired of being stared at. And two, I was hoping that he was weird like me because I don't quite fit in with my dad's side of the family. My boyfriend and I took the A train deep into Brooklyn to the funeral home, and when we got there, we were greeted outside by one of my cousins, who, when she saw me, said, "Oh, Daisy, your brother's in there. Go meet him." She said it like that. She said it like a command, as if it would not have occurred to me otherwise to do so. In my head, I reverted to being like a 12-year-old girl, and all I could think was, duh. So I walk in the building, and all of a sudden I realize that I'm kind of hiding behind my boyfriend and I'm peeking over his shoulder as we get up the stairs. I wasn't really nervous about it until that moment when I realized this is about to happen right now. And I got up the stairs and I tried to peek into the room because I wanted to get a glimpse of my brother before, you know, he saw me. And when I peeked in, I spotted him right away. I did. It was hard not to. He was the only person who was sitting with the family, whom I hadn't met before, who was in the right age range. I knew he was supposed to be about a year and a half older than me. But more than anything, he looked like me. I mean, he really looked like me. My entire life, I've always been told how much I look like my mom. And it's true. If you saw her, I got my skin color from her and my hair. But there's always been a little something about my face that I didn't quite know where it came from. It looked a little different. And if you asked me to tell you what it was, I couldn't explain it possibly. And the minute I saw my brother, he looked exactly like that inexplicable thing. Excited whispers started in the room as everyone realized I was standing at the door. And as I started to make my way across, everyone turned to me with this excited expectation. I wasn't expecting to see that at a funeral. It was more like the look I would think you would give to the entrance of a particularly grand cake at a wedding. And as I made my way across the room, I stopped in front of my brother and he stood up. And cameras came out and flashes went off as we started to hug because my family are emotional paparazzi. I had no idea what to say to him, and I just said the first thing that came into my head. And for you sports fans out there, I say, please forgive me, because this is over a year ago. It made more sense at the time. But the very first thing I said to my brother was, I whispered in his ear, you are the Brett Favre to my Eli Manning. I was so worried that after winning the Super Bowl, like, all the newspapers would be writing about me, and I'm kind of a shy player. But now that the Jets have traded for you last minute with all this controversy, nobody's writing about me at all. That's actually what I said to him. He didn't say anything. He just kind of started to sit down, and I wondered if I had said something wrong. The minute we broke our embrace, the family kind of started to swarm me. People were running up to me trying to, like, say hello and show me pictures, and my Aunt Margie barged right through the middle of them all, and in a voice you, again, wouldn't think anyone would use for anything at a funeral, said, oh, so you finally met your brother, huh? Well, maybe you can get him to talk because he doesn't say anything. She was standing about 2 feet away from him. I looked at all of this, and I took it in, and it occurred to me that if I was in my brother's position, it would look like I had been raised by this part of the family. And I didn't want him to think that I was the chosen child while he was out in California with no one looking for him, because the truth was that no one had looked for either one of us. And so when everyone was slightly out of earshot, I leaned in to my brother again and I said, hey, I just want you to know I didn't grow up with these people either. I was raised by my mom just like you were raised by yours, and I just met most of them at the hospital this week. So even then, it's not like I was there because he called me. I went looking for him a few years ago. My brother didn't say anything, but he shifted in his chair, and it felt like a larger shift had taken place as well. I don't know if it was that the air between us had warmed or that we were making more eye contact, but in a little while, I looked up to realize that we were talking. He and I had kind of moved into the corner, away from everyone, standing by the door where everyone could see us, because it was very clear that everyone wanted to be looking at us. And we just kind of were standing around commenting on the situation at hand. We weren't trying to catch up on everything that we had missed. No heavy conversation. Just kind of united in our awkwardness against this room full of an extended family and friends of a family that we didn't know. At one point, he turned to me and he said, what are you doing this weekend? Because I'm here until Monday and I hope you know I want to see you every day until then. I was surprised. And I liked the idea of it. I could see why now that we were beginning to chat, but I still didn't know what it meant. And then a little while later, he added, oh, by the way, I have a son. His name is Damien, and he's 12. You have a nephew. I really like the sound of that, because I'd grown up an only child, and I never thought I would have a niece or a nephew, but I still didn't even know what that meant. I mean, was I ever even going to meet this kid? As the day wound down, it was time for the speeches. And the official eulogy was given by one of our many cousins. This one happened to be a preacher. And he did a good job. He, recited what he said was my father's favorite psalm, and he told a couple of little anecdotes about my father's last few years, his realizations that the problems that he had gotten into in his youth had led him to where he was at the time. For example, he had always been known by this nickname on the streets. Like, ever since he was really young, my father had always been known by this nickname, so much so that more people in the room at the funeral home were calling him by that name than by his real name. And in his last few years, he didn't want the kids in the family to call him by that name. Now, that name was trouble, because that's what he is and that's what he was. And, you know, when you're from where he's from, you just need to let people know what they're dealing with right away. Like, there's no effort to be clever. It's just kind of like, this is the deal. So my father always was trouble. But in his last couple years, he insisted that the little kids in the family called him Bubbles because he didn't want them to associate him with such a negative name, you know? Which for him is like the sweetest thing, you know? And so they talked about that, and I thought it was nice, and then The preacher wrapped it up and sat back down. I started to look around the room, and I realized that people were kind of looking at me. And while I didn't have anything planned to say, you know, I had that moment where I thought, well, you only go to your father's funeral once. And if you don't say anything, you might regret it. And so I got up and I made my way across the room. I turned and I faced out into the audience, and they were just staring at me. I mean, much differently than this, they had spent their whole lives hearing about me but not meeting me. So they were not just looking at me, they were absorbing me with their eyes. They were trying to catch up on years worth of information in just that look. And since I had nothing planned and I didn't know where to begin, I just started there. And I said, I wish you could all see what it's like looking out onto all of you, looking back at me. But it's a lot. And, you know, you all very kindly keep coming up to me and telling me how sorry you are. But I have to tell you, I'm so sorry for your loss, because you all know him so much better than I ever did or I ever will. You have stories about him. I barely have any. I only have a couple from when I was really young. Like I have a story about the time that he promised to take me to the Bronx Zoo. And he took me to the Bronx. And then we sat in somebody's apartment most of the day, and then he got me to the zoo about 10 minutes before it closed, ran me through the exit so we didn't have to pay, and like went as fast as we could back out the entrance. Or like the time that he said he was going to take me to the movies, and he took me to see Exorcist 3. Which was like extra weird because I hadn't seen Exorcist 1 or 2, and I was 8 years old. Like, you guys, they laughed. And I was glad, because I didn't want them to think that I was making fun of him so much as those were the only stories I had, and I had long ago stopped associating any animosity with them. And I had just started to see the humor in them myself. I finished up what I had to say. I made my way back to my seat, and I was completely shocked when my brother got up and he walked across the room to the podium. I mean, if I didn't have anything to say, what was he going to say? He'd only met our father one time. He was spending the summer in New York with his mother's extended family, and I think one of our aunts took him to visit our father in prison. That was their only meeting when he was 7 years old. So what was he going to say? He got up there, and he looked out on everyone. He paused for a moment, seemingly taken aback by the crowd the same way I was, and then he began, I don't really care that he's dead. I mean, it's not that I don't care. I don't want to be rude or anything. It's just that, like, you know, I didn't know him at all, and it's like, I never even spoke to him, so, you know, I don't want to be rude. It's just, I wasn't even going to come here today. I mean, when they called and told me about it, I was thinking, why bother? But then on the phone, they said, you know, your sister wants to meet you. And when he said that, he started to well up, and he started to cry. And he didn't just start to cry, he started to bawl. And you could tell just by looking at him that he was not someone who cried often. And if you couldn't tell that by his demeanor, you could tell that by his reaction to crying, because it didn't make any sense. He didn't try to wipe away his tears. He tried to take the heels of his palm and jam everything back into his eyes, as if everything was just going to go right back where it came from. And then he continued, and he said, and now I've met her. And his voice broke up some, and he pointed towards me, and she's beautiful. And I was so stunned. I didn't know what to think or to feel. I knew he wanted to, like, have dinner this weekend, but I didn't know that I was the reason he had even gotten on the plane. And so I just sat there, overwhelmed by the sense of flattery, which I tell you, when you get up in the morning to go to your dad's funeral and you put on that terrible little black dress that you've bought for just that occasion, you do not think you're going to feel that at any point during that day. But that is all I could feel. Just shock and flattery. My whole family, because, you know, at a funeral, we all sit in the front row together. I'm sitting in the front row with them, and as this is happening, they all are looking at him, and they are crying, and then they all turn to me, and they say, Daisy, go be with your brother. Go be with your brother. Go stand next to your brother. Go be with your brother. Because for people that I didn't grow up knowing, they have no problem telling me exactly what they want me to be doing at any given moment. And so I got up, and I kind of awkwardly walked over there, and I got there and realized that I had nothing, so I just kind of awkwardly tapped him on the shoulder and stood back, and I guess I'll be here if you need me, pose. And he wrapped it all up by saying, yeah, and I have a son, so, you know, like, the Rosario name is going to go on or whatever. This is how I became both an aunt and a younger sister at my father's funeral. We did end up hanging out that weekend. We went to see Four Christmases. It was fine. We ended up talking and texting and emailing each other every day in the months that followed. And when my birthday came up, just about 2 months after, I was so happy and completely surprised to receive a huge shipping envelope full of birthday cards, 28 of them, in fact, one for every single year that we had not had together. We were constantly surprised to this day to realize how much we actually have in common for two people that didn't actually grow up anywhere near each other. Genetics are a pretty amazing thing. We laugh a lot, and I've gotten to go to his wedding. He's since gotten married, and he's come to visit here, and I've gone out there and taken my nephew to play video games and things like that. It's really amazing. But it was kind of crazy because one of the first things that we agreed upon, that first weekend, just sitting in a diner and talking, one of the things that we just both could not deny was that as much as you want it to happen a different way, you know, I didn't want my dad to have to die to meet my brother. I didn't want it to happen in this pattern. As much as you don't want any of that, with the lives that we had led, with the things that I had been going through the years before and the things that my brother had going on in his life, we realized that it couldn't have happened any other way. And it'd be nice if it could, but it is what it is. And we couldn't be happier to find each other. Thank you.
That was Daisy Rosario. To learn more about The Moth, go to themoth.org, where you can also pitch a story of your own. You can record your pitch right on our site or call 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. In a moment, our final story about a dream gig that became a hell gig.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear from people who really make you think, like astrophysicist Brian Greene explaining the scientific theory that our universe is just one of many.
And the image that I like to have in mind is, imagine that our universe is like one slice of bread in a much grander cosmic loaf, with the other slices of bread being other universes.
No subject is too big for Fresh Air. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Welcome back. I'm Mike Birbiglia, and you're listening to the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. So, our last story is from Colin Quinn. He was a headliner for a show themed New York Stories. It was actually a benefit for the Moth Shop Community Program, and Colin donated his time. This is actually a story that really hits close to home for me. As a comedian, you know, it's very difficult because when you're not doing well with an audience, you know, you really feel judged, you know, because it's not like in a play or a movie where if people don't like it, they can go, well, we don't like the set or the script or the costumes. With stand-up comedy, if people don't like it, they're basically saying, we don't like you. You know, your personality. Well, this is one of my favorite hell gig stories. This is Colin Quinn, live at the Moth.
About 4 months ago, I get a phone call. De Niro's wife calls me and says, look, I'm having a surprise party for De Niro. Would you go and do stand-up comedy at the restaurant? So now I'm very jaded. You have to understand it. You know, I was jaded to begin with, but just being in show business, you know, you get very jaded. You don't want to do anybody's stupid birthday party, especially because it's going to be in a restaurant. And, you know, it's just a hell gig. Like, after a while, you get to know where the hell gigs are. You know, it's just a bad setup. People are eating, you know. But this is different because it's De Niro, and like any other guy, I have that thing about De Niro, you know what I mean? Like, where I'm like, you know, De Niro, and it's not just a worship of De Niro, it's also like, I secretly feel like if De Niro ever got to spend some time with me, and, you know, that he'd really, you know, pretty soon it'd be like, you know, Robert De Niro and Colin Quinn starring in the Martin Scorsese production of, you know. And I figured worst comes to worst, Scorsese will be there and he'll see me and he'll be like, oh my God, what's this guy been hiding from for so many years, right? And I'm not even really into like acting. I mean, I'm a comedian. That's what I love to do. But, you know, a De Niro Scorsese movie, I would accept. So, you know, only if it was like a real, you know, man-on-man part kind of thing, you know? So, and when you do these gigs, if it's a one-night gig, like this is going to be, I think it's called Le Cirque. Whatever's across in St. Patrick's Cathedral, it's a famous restaurant like Le Cirque. I could be wrong on the name. I think it's called Le Cirque, but it's on Fifth Avenue in some, freaking Trump Hotel or something. I don't even know it. But is it Le Cirque?
Yeah.
Good. So, all right, it's in Le Cirque. So, usually you don't prepare for one night. You're not going to write 20 minutes of material to do one stupid night of comedy. It's a waste of time. You know, you work some stuff in about the local thing, you bust balls at the table, and then you do your act, you know? And, you know, you're not going to write 20 specific minutes or a half hour specific minutes. You couldn't do that every night. It's ridiculous, right? And memorize it, right? So, but this is different. De Niro, as I say, you know? So, I actually wrote out, I sat home for like 3 nights in a row and sat there like, you know, and it's pathetic because I'm too old to be like that enthusiastic about anything, you know? But here I am like writing home. I didn't hear anything. And I set it up into three parts. One part was me coming out, and I know from being a comedian for 20 years, you come out, you start zinging people with quick ones, start hitting them with it, because it's like a roast. There's all these people, they're not expecting a comedian. I know how these gigs go. Boom, boom, start slamming people, get a few laughs. Then I was going into like a kind of humorous story about the first time I heard about De Niro, but like a true story that's humorous and kind of poignant, right? And then the third part is going to be me. It's humiliating to say, but it was going to be me doing, because every guy knows some scenes from all of De Niro's movies, it was me doing like little scenes. I mean, I've never been like this in my life, you know? Scenes from De Niro's movies playing all the little characters, because I figured I memorized all the scenes. He'll probably go nuts, go, this guy knows every line and every... Meanwhile, every guy knows every line of every De Niro movie, but, you know. But I figured I was kind of representing all of us that like De Niro, you know? And, you know, because De Niro, like, I think this is... Plus, I had just gotten to the point stand-up-wise after all these years where I was like, you know, my act, I'm so tight on stage, blah, blah, blah. I know exactly what I'm doing. I can free yourself. Anything I do, I just know how to do it. This is like meant to be, that his wife would call me at this time in my life when, like, you know, I'm really tight, you know, comedically. So anyway, I go to the gig, you know. I get to the gig, and I see already it's kind of like a weird... There's a side room. All the kids are playing in the side room at Le Cirque. So I'm ready. I'm like, oh, there are kids in here. And it's like, it's not even dark yet. You know, it's almost dark. It's like, I pull up in a cab. I go in there. They give me a mic. The staff is looking at me like, oh, you know, like all actors. Like, I wish I could be like this guy. You know, he's successful. They give me a cordless mic. I'm in the side. There's like probably 80 people, but like heavyweights. I got like... Erwin Winkler type people. I don't even know if he was there, but people like, you know, these like names you haven't heard in 20 years, but they're real powerhouses, you know? And like, at one table, it's Billy Crystal, Whoopi Goldberg, and Robin Williams in the corner. So, but that doesn't bother me because, you know, it doesn't bother me. You know, then they got, please wait. And then, now Billy Crystal, by the way, doesn't like me, because, and I don't blame him. Every time he put on SNL, he told some friend of mine, what's Colin Quinn's problem? Every time he put on SNL, he's slamming one of my movies. What, does he hate me or something? So, of course, that makes me pissed at him. Like, what does he hate care for? But, of course, if that was me, if I was him, I'd feel the same way. But it doesn't matter. So me and him have never met, but there's a lot of static, right? So now, then on the other side of the room, you got Chris Walken, Harvey Keitel, all these guys, right? So I go with my, so there's a podium, cordless mic, and you can sense a hell gig, but like I said, after a certain amount of years, you're bigger, you can rock, you've turned around gigs, hell gigs, doesn't matter. So especially because I have all this specific material, so I get a little podium for my three-part De Niro thing, right? Because, you know, I can't, just in case, I want to make sure I get it all in. So I go up there, everyone's eating, she goes... nobody introduces me. Just let him go up at the mic. So that's always a good... So, but it doesn't matter. So they got all the people eating, but the first course... I said, don't put me on. Put me on after the course. I'm telling the wife. We're backstage plotting. It's a surprise. Nobody knows I'm there, right? Except for the wife. I go out there. Hey! And everyone's looking. I go, oh, it's great to be here, De Niro. You know, I met him once very briefly on SNL, but... So everybody's like, okay, who is this son of a... right? So... But I think they all know me, you know? I'm like, yeah. And then I go, so I figure I'll start with a few roast zingers to get the crowd going, you know? So I go, hey, De Niro, I'll tell you the truth. I really love, you're one of the greatest actors of all time. Do you do any other accents? And everyone looks at me like, you know. And then I go, no, seriously, you prepare for your roles very seriously. You know, you gain weight for Raging Bull, then for The Untouchables, you put on a few. Hey, maybe you're just a fat who likes to eat. Just looking at me. Who's this son of insulting De Niro? It's his birthday. It's a big birthday, man. You know? So a couple of them know me, sort of, but they're still wondering why I'm here. Nobody knew. So I'm still trying to get De Niro. So I go, oh, boy. Hey, I heard you prepare for your roles, you know, very seriously for months. How do you prepare for Rocky and Bullwinkle? By looking in the mirror and apologizing to your fans? Woo! So now, all right. Now I realize I'm bombing, you know? Already it's starting. And like, you know, I'm looking out the window. I see St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is kind of like symbolic. Like, I don't know, right? And then and it's kind of raining out. You know, it's like, it's still not dark, you know? It's bad enough. It's a bad environment of comedy. And so I say, they're obviously here for De Niro. I'm not stupid. I move over to Keitel and Walker, and those guys, I'll slam them for a few minutes. So they're sitting over there. So I go, hey, Keitel, why don't you make yourself at home? Take your pants off. Now, I know it was only like one movie he did it, but, you know, he's kind of known for it anyway. So then I go, Chris Wood. So that guy's, you know, less than nothing now, you know. Then I go to Chris Walker, and I go, hey, Chris Walker, what are you doing here? Shouldn't you be doing a cameo in an unwatchable independent film? Oh, I'm singing him. And the dumb girl with him is like, applauding. She thinks I just said something good about him, you know? So normally in a situation like this, a pro comedian like myself or anybody else, you realize you're starting to sweat, you go into your act, you know? But I know my act is not going to work, and I'm looking over, and I can know. I just know. I can't really see them in the back table, but I know Billy Crystal must be living his glory right now. He must be so happy to see me fall. You know what I'm saying? I can't see him between Robin and Whoopi, but I know he must be back there just eating it up. So now, of course, I'm bombing with the roast things. So now, instead of going into my act, which probably wouldn't have worked, but it would have been better than nothing, I start trying to go into my story about the emotional time and the De Niro story. And now my mouth is dry. I'm saying things out of sequence, because that's what happens when you start bombing. You're saying things out of sequence, and you're like saying words out of order, you know, this one backwards. And I'm like, you know, I mean, De Niro seriously is a great, yeah, great guy. Like, they need me, the guy that doesn't know him, to say, seriously, though, he's good people. Let me just give him my stamp of approval. Like, yeah, moves up. You know? So they're looking at me with semi-hate. A couple of people had pity, but mostly it was hate. And, you know, and De Niro goes, keep going. A couple of people start heckling me, like old people start, like, you know, hostily, like, yelling, like, hey. And De Niro goes, hey, I think you're funny. And so, like, he's pitying me. It's really pathetic. So I go, thanks, Bob. And, you know, I try to, like, improv off him. And, I mean, once you bomb, once the audience hates you, it's over. There's no point in... It doesn't matter what you do, you know what I mean? When it's over, that's it. So, but for some reason, I can't let myself give up my dream. I had this whole dream put together of me and De Niro, and, you know, I mean, you know, it's not that I do that all the time. I'm not some starstruck kid. I'm thinking, you know, but this is the one. And it was just, so anyway, I get to part three. Now, this is the worst part, because here I am behind a podium. Everybody hates my guts. It's uncomfortable. All the waiters that were jealous of all the actors are looking at me like, I would rather wait tables for 20 years than be this ass. You know? They were like totally just like, oh. I mean, they were really looking disgusted at me. So then I actually go into, like, and I'm not known for my vocal range, as we know. I go into Goodfellas. The scene, if you know Goodfellas, in the bar with Billy Betts, De Niro, Joe Pesci, and somebody else, and Frank Vincent, and it's like four people in the scene. I'm actually doing a reenactment of the scene. You know, I mean, and I'm doing each of the different characters, of course, the same voice with each of them, you know, which could work with that actual scene. But I'm like, hey, hey, Billy, hey, Joe, and I'm moving like this to show the different people. And I mean, people are just mortified, you know? Because now even De Niro's wife, who set the whole thing up, who I blame, even she's looking at me pissed off. Now, get off, you know what I mean? She's like, get off, you know what I mean? It's like and I'm doing this thing, and I'm looking at St. Patrick's across the street, and it's just like, and then one lady goes, oh, like she felt sorry for me. Just, oh. And now I had on a, I had another gig, so I had two shirts. I had a nice, I just brought this cashmere shirt, and I was a little excited. I had it with me, you know, but I don't ever carry bags in my family. We never carry, like, God forbid, like, you know, suit bags. You just carry it with you. That's how we do. So I got a suit on, nice suit, nice shirt, which is soaked through to the core with sweat. I mean, it's really, my whole face is sweating. I mean, just a shame-filled nobody. And these are people that study faces, like actors and directors. They could see shame. You know, I feel like they could see inside like an x-ray. I'm just filled with shame. My whole life is miserable, you know? And then, so finally, I just go, happy birthday, Charlie Brown. Yeah, like, hey, seriously, happy birthday. And, you know, I get off stage. It's like, you know, there's a smattering sort of applause. But even, you know, when they're mad at you, even if they kind of feel like bad, they still can't really applaud. They resent you for, you know, wasting and ruining the party, whatever. So I go outside. I'm trying to, like, you know, get the whole thing together. So Robin Williams comes outside. I'm standing on Fifth Avenue because I have to go to this other gig. Robin Williams comes outside crying with laughter. He knows me a little bit. He's laughing his off. He goes, you went up there. My wife goes, what's that guy doing with the microphone talking? What's he doing up there, Robin? And she told him, go up and save him at some point. That would have been, the only way this story would have been worse is if Robin Williams had come up and started doing his improv and saved me. And the whole crowd was like, oh, Robin, you saved this idiot, you know? So thank God he didn't, you know, he knows better. Anyway, the end of the story is me talking to Robin and just saying, you know, it's like, it doesn't bother me, Robin, because I'm, you know, I'm just talking about gigs, you know, it's another bomb, you know, it doesn't matter. You don't really look at it like, you know. And then he starts laughing because what happened was my stupid shirt, my new cashmere shirt, he didn't know it was my new, very exciting cashmere shirt that I bought. It was kind of raining, like I said, you know. It fell off the hanger and it was just in a puddle. And as I but only a little bit of it was in the water part. As I turned around to get it, and I'm not kidding, ask Robin Williams if you know him. As I turned around to get it, a car rolled my shirt. Happy birthday, Bob.
That was Colin Quinn live at the Moth. Colin is a comedian. He hosted Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live and recently did a limited engagement of his one-man show called Long Story Short, directed by comedy legend Jerry Seinfeld. To learn more about The Moth, go to themoth.org, where you can also check out The Moth's free weekly podcast or pitch a story of your own. All of the stories you're hearing and many more Moth favorites are available at the iTunes store. Just search for The Best of The Moth. That's it for this episode of The Moth Radio Hour. And if you're eager to share a story of your own, consider a visit to our pitch line.
I want to pitch my story about my honeymoon in the Kaziranga game forest in Assam. This is like in the boonies of northeast India, like right where the rainforest border Burma and China. I had taken my husband there, and the poor guy is from Boca Raton, Florida, and he had no idea of how remote and crazy this place is, and neither had I, because I have been gone 25 years. And when I went back, the tea plantation where I took him to and this game sanctuary was overrun by the terrorists, the Bodos, who were going around, you know, killing people and sticking their heads on spikes and stuff like that. And the thing is that we were in this crazy honeymoon in the middle of this game sanctuary, and everything that could go wrong went wrong. I mean, we're talking about, you know, almost getting attacked by wild elephants and getting stuck in the mud and, you know, and all these, and having a really cross-eyed, completely cross-eyed guard who had a gun with no bullets in it. I mean, it doesn't happen to people. I think God kind of played a prank on us or something, but we survived it. 16 years later, I'm here to tell the tale, and I'm happily married, live in Phoenix, Arizona. And later on, when we thought about it and we laughed about it, and we decided that if we can survive this honeymoon, we can survive anything.
You can pitch your own story at themoth.org. You can record your pitch right on the site or call 877-799-MOTH. which is 877-799-6684. Again, our website is themoth.org, and we hope you'll tune in next time.
Your host this hour was Mike Birbiglia. Mike is a frequent host of the Moth's live events and the author of the comedic memoir Sleepwalk With Me and other painfully true stories.
All right, folks. So what we're going to do with all these other brave souls that can't get a chance to tell a story, I want you to come up and tell like a one or two sentence synopsis of what your story was going to be about. All right, let's go.
The stories in this hour were directed by Catherine Burns and Jennifer Hickson. The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Jeunesse, and Meg Bowles. Production support from Jenna Weiss-Berman and Brandon Hector.
My father is an American hero and his sons are not.
Moth stories are true as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest.
My friend who set me up on a blind date said, I can't believe you bailed because he was missing an arm. And I said, he was missing an arm?
Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Albert Collins, John Zorn, and Indigo Jam Unit. The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, with help from Vicki Merrick.
And my mother yelled to me up in my room and said, Debbie, get downstairs, come meet your father, uncle.
This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant